Good afternoon. I would like to call House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today is Thursday, May 10th. Let the record reflect, it is 2:46 p.m. Today we have present Representative Groh, Representative Carpenter, Representative Eastman, Representative Gray, Vice Chair Allard, and myself, Chair Vance. I would like to remind committee members and those in the audience to please silence your cell phones. The staff assisting us today is Kevin Allen with the House Records and Talia Ames with the Juno LAO. Thank you. And hopefully we won't be having too many technical difficulties. We do give our apologies to the public ahead of time. There have been telephone and internet issues, so we apologize if there is any delay. So the committee will bring back House Bill 4, Elections Repeal Ranked Choice Voting, in its third hearing today and take up amendments. And then we will also bring back Senate Bill 53, Competency and Voluntary Civil Commitments, by Senator Klayman in its second hearing. Briefly, as time allows, I would like to note that we will have a hard stop at 4 p.m. because we are already going to be going over the usual allotted committee time, and there are other committees and meetings later today. So we do have two amendments that I'd like to take up first, and then we have the drafter on House Bill 4, Noah Klein from Legislative Legal. We have Ms. Carol Beecher, the Director of Division of Elections, Thomas Flynn, the Assistant Attorney General of Department of Law, who advises Department of Elections, available to answer members' questions. Representative Eastman, amendment number one.
Thank you. I will move amendment number one.
Object for purposes of discussion.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Currently, when you or I are going online to fill out our application for a permanent fund dividend, there's a series of questions that you can answer dealing with voter registration issues. And at the end of your application process, you can either have a new voter registration or, in your case or mine, that voter registration could be updated with a new address or a new party or something like that. This amendment would make sure that that process is opt-in, so that anyone who's going through that process and applying for the dividend, if they so choose, could click the box and then they could be taken to the voter registration portion of that, or they could not click the box, in which case they wouldn't have to answer those questions. And then there would be no question as to whether or not in filing their dividend application they were also changing their voter registration. I have heard from I don't even know how many voters who, going through that process of applying for a dividend, their voter address was changed, and they didn't want it to be changed. They didn't move, but the address that they were using, for the dividend application ended up inadvertently changing their address. I'm sure you're familiar with similar instances like that. This would solve that problem.
Thank you. Questions from Vice Chair Allard?
I really like this amendment. Thank you, Representative Eastman, for bringing this forward.
Any further questions on amendment number one? Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, it's a basic question, and I have applied for the PFD, but I don't remember the part about voter registration, and so I'm just curious about what the current process is, so I understand how this will change it. Thank you.
Do you have a specific question?
Yes. When someone does their PFD and that changes their voter registration address, is that because it's automatically clicking the button to update their voter registration and this would make it an opt-in only, or is that a mistake that's happening? It's never happened to me because I've always used the same address for my PFD and my voter registration. So the problem that we're fixing, I was curious if there was any idea about why that happened. That was the question. Thank you.
I believe that either Thomas Flynn with the Department of Law or Ms. Beecher can answer that question. Mr. Flynn, are you available to answer that question?
Yes, Representative Vance, this is Tom Flynn at the Department of Law. Essentially, the PFD AVR, as we call it, automatic voter registration, is just that, automatic. So So you don't have to click anything. It happens automatically when you apply for the PFD. And Director Beecher can add anything that I've missed.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, I would not add anything to that. It is it happens automatically.
Ms. Beecher, would you be able to speak to some of the difficulties that people experienced with their addresses? I know that you were not in the division at the time, but are you familiar with a lot of those complaints that came in the past couple of years?
Through the chair, Chair Vance, I have, in speaking with my staff, I have heard that we did hear from many individuals since the implementation of the automatic registration, and that they were not happy about being registered by the automated method, and it had to do primarily with the address changes that occurred from whatever address they had put into their PFD application that then changed their voter registration. And from what I understand, they even went to precinct to vote and worked on that registration list because of the change of their address.
Thank you, Ms. Beecher. Representative Gray, follow-up.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, my follow-up is, why are people using different addresses for voting and for PFDs?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, I don't have an answer for you on that. I'm not sure why that would. It just depends on what address they put on there, if it was different than their voter registration address.
Thank you.
I'd like to let the record reflect we've been joined by Representative Johnson at 2:51 p.m. Any further questions on Amendment Number 1? Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the chair, because Representative Gray had said it publicly, I can give, not a whole bunch of reasons, but I could give why, if I'm snowbirding, why I might have my mailing address down in the lower 48, because I might be snowbirding in November, which is winter. But I could still qualify for the PFD and be up here, and my permanent address is technically Eagle River.
Follow up, Representative Gray.
If you want to vote in Alaska, through the chair, if you want to vote in Alaska, it would seem to me that you would want your voter registration to be in Alaska. So you would want the PFD to also be your Alaska address. So just in the interest of election integrity, I would want those addresses to be the same.
Thank you.
In closing, Representative Eason.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. And I, in an ideal world, it'd be nice if we all just had one address and could stick to it. People have confidential addresses that they give to the Division of Elections that they don't want anybody else knowing about, and they don't want it, publicized. And they have, of course, their regular address, mailing address. I think on the voter roll, there's either two or three different columns for different addresses for the same voter because of things like that. But the problem isn't when you go onto your dividend application and you're trying to change your voter registration to a particular address. The problem usually comes in when you're going on to apply for your dividend. You don't want to do anything with your voter registration. You don't want to change anything with your voter registration. And then through what you're filling out for your PFD application, you find out afterwards that through maybe a fault of your own or depending, no fault of your own, the system decided that it wanted to change your voter registration despite the fact that that was not your intent. And so this would solve that problem.
Thank you. Is the objection maintained?
I will make an objection to maintain it.
We're on Amendment Number 1, Representative Johnson. Well, there's.
I don't know who objected.
There are prior objections.
You said object if you withdraw.
Representative Carpenter, you had made an objection. Do you maintain your objection?
I do not maintain my objection.
Okay.
I object.
I forgot that I objected.
Whew. Okay. I'm just trying to have a clear record here. Representative Gray has made an objection. Would the recorder please?
Madam Chair, before you start, I do not feel confident in voting on this, and my stepping out of the room has nothing to do with anything other than me not wanting to vote on something I'm not familiar with. So I promise you I'll be caught up on amendment number two.
Brief at ease for a moment. Back on the record, Representative Johnson, are you?
I'm prepared to vote.
Thank you.
I've become acquainted with the amendment.
Thank you. Would the recorder please call the vote on amendment number one?
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Grove?
Yes.
Representative Carpenter?
Yes.
Yes.
Representative Gray?
No.
Vice Chair Ellen?
Yes.
Chair Vance?
Yes.
You need to call on Representative. Missing one.
You have to call me again.
Would the recorder please void the roll and call it again?
Okay. In order, Representative Jones?
Yes.
Representative Rowe?
No.
Representative Carpenter?
Yes.
Representative Houston?
Yes.
Representative Gray?
No.
Yes.
Chair Vance?
Yes.
Five yeas, two nays?
By a vote of five yeas and two nays, amendment number one has been adopted. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I move amendment two.
Object for purpose.
There has been objection. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Many of the complaints and concerns and feedback I've received from voters have dealt with ballot measure two and upset over ballot measure two over the fact that it had these different parts to it that didn't seem to all maybe fit in the same, you know, subject or same theme. And so I guess more than anything, the request that I've received is that we ought to repeal ballot measure two in its entirety and start afresh. And so this amendment would accomplish that. There's one caveat. In addition to simply repealing ballot measure two, since the passage of ballot measure two, there was legislation that we had passed. I believe it was introduced by Senator Willikowski, which updated the definition of political party in state law. This does not try to change that or repeal that. It leaves that unchanged. Other than that, this amendment is simply to completely repeal ballot measure two.
Questions on amendment number two? Representative Carpenter.
Yeah, so I'm just reading through the amendment at this time, but I thought that the underlying bill was repealing ballot measure two, so I'm not sure why this would be necessary. So I need to understand it.
I can respond to that, if you need.
Madam Chair, may we take just a brief at ease?
Brief at ease? back on record. Representative Eastman, while members are going through this, can you walk us through Amendment Number 2, since it is rather lengthy? Can you walk us through some of, more specifically, of what those changes include?
Yeah, be glad to. So House Bill 4, as of this moment, is a partial repeal of Ballot Measure 2. It could be called a repeal of ranked choice voting. What Amendment 2 would do would make House Bill 4 a complete repeal of Ballot Measure 2. Again, with the only exception being the slight change to the definition of political party, which has changed in state law since after the passage of Ballot Measure 2. But in all other respects, this is a complete repeal of Ballot Measure 2. And the reason it's long is not because I asked for it to be long, but because Ballot Measure 2 was more than 25 pages long. And that, again, is part of some of the concern and some of the confusion in some voters as to what it was that they had either voted for or voted against. And the ballot measure itself accomplished the changes of adding restrictions to fundraising and getting rid of our primary election system, which we've had for some number of years here in Alaska. And then also, in addition to that, the third component was implementing ranked choice voting. And so the Amendment 2 would simply, in total, be a complete repeal of all three of those changes that were that took place in Ballot Measure 2.
Representative Eastman, does this amendment include the changes with the updates of the court cases that are specifically outlined in House Bill 4?
Yes, it doesn't touch those court cases at all. I'm certainly glad to potentially support those changes, but for simplicity and clarity, this is simply a straight repeal of Ballot Measure 2 without changing any of the words or phrases or taking any court cases into consideration. But I think it's a valid and important concern that is worth addressing.
Thank you. I do have a question, and I'm not sure if it should be for Mr. Flynn. Mr. Flynn, I've received questions or actually complaints and concerns from constituents who are getting letters in the mail of fees from APOC being imposed on them because they made a contribution to a ballot measure. And they were unaware that they were required to file with APOC that they had made, for instance, a $500 contribution. And now they recently got a letter. Just a few days ago, they had a letter of more than $8,000 in fines from APOC, and they were completely unaware. And is that provision of an individual making this contribution the results of the passage of Ballot Measure 2 that Amendment Number 2 would be seeking to repeal?
Chair Vance, this is Tom Flynn at the Department of Law. I'm afraid I don't have an answer for that. I'd advise the Division of Elections and not APOC, but I'm happy to take that question to the APOC attorney or to APOC and get back to you.
Thank you for that. Mr. Klein, is this something that that you can provide any insight as our legislative legal? I know that you obviously haven't seen the letter that my constituent received from APOC specifically, but is that type of action something that was implemented with Ballot Measure 2 that Amendment Number 2 would be seeking to repeal?
To the chair, this is Noah Klein, Legislative Legal Services. Like you referenced, Representative Vance, Chair Vance, I haven't seen the letter, and I would also defer to APOC on a question related to the campaign finance statutes.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and I can speak to that in as much as I've received similar complaints from Alaskans and probably from different people, but also caught up under the same issue. And the issue arose because under Ballot Measure 2, we instituted for the first time a double reporting requirement. Under certain circumstances, because of the way Ballot Measure 2 is written, not only does the recipient of a donation record and report that information to APOC, but now there's also a double requirement. And so the person who gives the money also has to make a report. And that's something that is brand new. We've not had that requirement in state law before, but that did come in through ballot measure 2 and through amendment 2. Since it's repealing all of ballot measure 2, that requirement is eliminated as well.
Any further questions on amendment number 2? Representative Carpenter.
Well, I'm I don't know that I've got a question, but I know that there are some folks that they like that when they see an advertisement and it says this communication was paid for in broadcast and cable, internet, other digital communications, and it's paid for and it lists the top contributors, they're really interested in seeing that. And that's a positive thing, but it appears that we would be taking that out in broadcast cable, satellite, internet, or other digital communications. It would no longer be required. So that's one part of this that I have a hard time getting support for.
Representative Gray.
Madam Chair, I don't recall any ballot measures on the 2022 ballot, statewide ballot. I mean, and I know we were just talking about it, and so I was just curious if the maker of the amendment can remind me what ballot measures we saw last year, because I don't remember voting on them.
Representative Eastman.
I think if I misspoke, we're dealing with ballot measure 2. The last time we had a ballot measure 2 was when we implemented ranked choice voting. And so that's all this is referring to.
Well, I just want to say that there are provisions that I think that we need to address and clean up. I think one of them being the additional requirement of individuals having to report to APOC when they're completely unaware that that they would have to file that notification and are being heavily fined. I would have been very angry and shocked to receive a more than $8,000 fine from the state of Alaska, feeling like I was doing a good thing by contributing to something and having not been made aware. However, as mentioned, there's other things that I feel the public wanted, and I've already been accused of going against the will of the people to repeal the ranked choice voting portion. This, a lot of the provisions that are in here is something that I feel people wanted and thought they were voting for with ballot measure 2. And I do not want to go against the will of the people in what they thought they were voting for, but I do recognize there are areas that we need to have further policy discussions on to address and make right, because there are things that maybe unintended consequences, which I think a lot of ballot measure 2 was very much unintended consequences. And instead of trying to parse out different areas of this amendment, I'm not going to be able to support it today. Representative Gray.
Thank you. So I, through the chair, just a follow-up on the ballot measure issue. So the APOC fines for not submitting a disclosure to APOC for donating to a ballot measure, I assume those were for municipal ballot measures.
No.
Then I need explanation of what ballot measures that ballot measure 2 required APOC disclosures for if we didn't have any ballot measures on the 2022 ballot. I just don't know what ballot measures they got in trouble for making unreported donations to.
Representative Gray, it was from 2020.
Oh.
The last election, we did have the constitutional question, mm-hmm. and there were campaigns, there we go, for or against the constitutional. So it was a question on the ballot. There were campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I misspoke in what that donation was. But the impact of that change came from ballot measure 2 of 2020. Does that clarify?
So I'll just make sure I understand through the chair, or I guess to the chair. So we had ballot measure 2, which had these new provisions which required disclosures to APOC that people were not aware of. and we passed it. And so for that election that ballot measure 2 appeared on, if people had done undisclosed donations, then they were fined.
That was not implemented
okay.
at that time, but it right. was implemented in the 2022 election.
Roger. And so my question, Madam Chair, was that I assumed it was municipal ballot measures because everyone's shaking their head. What state ballot measures did we have in 2022 that people got in trouble for? Thank you. I'm so sorry.
Point of order. I don't know what we're talking about.
Representative Carpenter.
I don't know what we're talking
about. I can try and clarify.
I don't know what we're talking about because there's not something before me. There's not something before this committee to take action on or information being presented to us.
Amendment 2.
Amendment 2 has nothing to
do
with.
Hold on. This committee must be addressed through the chair. Thank you. Representative Carpenter is speaking.
To the chair. I don't know what we're discussing right now because there isn't a document before me that is highlighting somebody getting charged for something, and there's not a statute that's being referenced in particular that I can reference. I don't have data in front of me to have that conversation, so I feel completely unprepared to be speculating on that line of questioning.
Representative Carpenter, if I am accurate, page 3 of the amendment, section 11, a person who fails to register when required fails to file a properly completed report. Civil penalty of not more than $50 a day for delinquency, I believe, could be what my constituents have been facing in APOC fines.
To the chair, it is the could be part of that that causes me pause. If I knew that and I had that in front of me, then I would know, but I'm not prepared to discuss something that could be. I want to know that that's exactly what we're talking about, not could be. That's what my point is. We'll go down this rabbit hole on a whole lot of things that could be.
Representative Crow.
Madam Chair, could I ask a question? If the answer might answer Representative Gray's question. Is it accurate to say that you were saying that some of your constituents made contributions in the 2021-2022 cycle regarding the question on the 2022 ballot, or whether shall there be a constitutional convention that later apparently triggered fines from APOC under ballot measure 2 as adopted in 2020. Is that accurate?
Correct.
Okay.
Okay, the question before us is, shall we adopt amendment number 2? And some of the discussion has been the impacts of what this legislation seeks to repeal, or this amendment, excuse me, seeks to repeal. So I believe that there are more questions than answers, but it is the amendment before us. Final wrap-up, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I'm glad to provide answers to some of those questions. To respond to Representative Groh, to be very clear, the amendment before you would remove the language which was passed in ballot measure 2, which triggered the double reporting requirement for the state constitutional convention question. It wasn't that the donations weren't disclosed, because historically and under ballot measure 2, if you're running a campaign either for or against a ballot measure or a state constitutional convention question, you're required to, you know, collect money and report it to APOC. And that's the same either way. What was new under ballot measure 2, passed in 2020, applied in the 2022 election, is that now as a donor to any of those campaigns, you also, under certain circumstances, have a requirement in addition to the report that they filed APOC, you also have to file your own separate report as a contributor. And that I know is what was behind the concerns that my office received and dealing with, you know, potential fines over $8,000, which they had no idea about. But so that would be resolved in this amendment. To the concern from the chair, the problem with trying to pass ballot measure 2 or any other ballot measure that's between 25 and 30 pages on election day is that none of that was vetted by the legislature. None of that came through our committee or any other legislative committee. It simply was written by some attorneys and it was passed. And I offer this amendment now, not because there aren't some things in ballot measure 2. I mean, 30 pages. Of course, there's some good things in there. And I think there's probably some things that we would all, or at least many of us, would want to keep. Representative Carpenter mentioned, you know, the cable television, you know, advertisement notification requirement. Maybe that's, you know, one of the things that's worth keeping. But the problem with leaving it in and voting against this amendment is that, again, you skip the vetting, which the legislature should have done in passing that type of law to begin with. And my fear is that if we don't start anew by simply repealing all the language and then bring back those portions that are appropriate to keep, that we will have no oversight, no investigation, no public testimony, no consideration of each of those elements. Whereas if we were to pass ballot measure 2, then we could begin that process and we could look at things like the advertisement requirement and say, well, maybe that makes a lot of sense. And we could take that through the legislative process and come up with a good product, hopefully.
Thank you, Representative Eastman. Would the recorder please call the roll on amendment number 2?
Representative Johnson?
Pass.
Representative Brooks?
No.
Representative Carpenter?
No.
Representative Eastman?
Yes.
Representative Gray?
No.
Vice Chair Albert?
Yes.
No.
And Chair Van.
No.
Four nays, 2
nays. By a vote of 4 nays and 2 nays, amendment number 2 has not been adopted.
There's 7 at the table.
Excuse me.
There's 7 at the table.
My apologies. That is 5 nays and 2 yays. Amendment number 2 has failed to be adopted. So that brings House Bill 4 before us as amended. Do members have any questions before we on House Bill 4? Any comments on House before we decide to take action? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the discussion that we just had about the complexity and the multiple pages to kind of hide ranked choice voting, if you will, if that was intentional or not, that was the result. I think that gives more emphasis than most of the testimony I've heard over the last weeks about repealing ranked choice voting. So I strongly support it, and I'm confused, and I was there. Thank you.
Any further comments? Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'll just say that the majority of testimony we heard was opposed to this bill. I believe that Alaskans are smart enough to understand ranked choice voting, and I will be opposed to this bill. Thank you.
Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair. I support this bill because I've heard from my constituents and others, and I've seen the surveys from the Alaska Chamber of Commerce, that the numbers have flipped. And after it was approved by the people of Alaska, many of them felt they were a little bit duped. And they've come out saying, we don't want this. And that's the amazing thing about this bill. We tried it, and with the jungle primaries in August with our Congress, that was a hot mess. So for those reasons and a whole bunch more, I'm going to support this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Groh.
Well, I thought ballot measure 2 was, at the time, was good public policy. I supported it. I support it now. I'm going to vote no.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I appreciate the comments. I think they all have some merit. I would say, though, as I'm engaging with just by being on this committee and receiving feedback from the public, there is a very, how should I say, if it's not partisan, there's a very candidate-driven focus to a lot of the support and opposition to ballot measure 2, now ranked choice voting. And it is, and I think that can sort of take the place of discussion on the merits of the law itself, because we now have under ballot measure 2, you know, there was the idea that you would need to get a majority support in a particular race in order to be elected. But that's not actually the way that ballot measure 2 is written. If you receive, you know, less than 50% support, even after you get your second and third and fourth, whatever, you know, place votes counted towards your name, and you get less than 50% votes of the people who voted in your race, you can still get elected. And we have about half a dozen different legislators in this body and in the other body who are sitting here in the legislature today after receiving less than 50%, you know, votes from their respective races of those who participated. And so the idea, I mean, the kind of the messaging hasn't always reflected the reality of the bill. And a lot of voters probably aren't going to take the time to read 30 pages of a bill or even understand necessarily what all the legal ramifications of that are. And so I appreciate that there is some support for the system, there's support for some of the messaging, but also I just find that when I'm interacting with particularly those who are supporting keeping ranked choice voting, sometimes they still don't understand exactly what it does. And that's concerning. And I think if the bill had gone through the legislature, there would have been more time and consideration so that the public could better understand what was actually in the bill than what took place. And there were some 6 million reasons why the bill passed, as is too often the case at the ballot box. But regardless, I think it's important that the legislature vets and deals with some of the very complex issues that ballot measure 2 raises.
Thank you. And Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to share a little bit of my thinking here on why I'm supporting this bill. So I heard a lot of criticism of political parties through the public testimony, and I know that that's a part of why people voted for ballot measure 2 was kind of a disdain for political parties. In Alaska's independent registered voters demonstrates that Alaskans have a disdain for political parties. But I'd just like to point out that one or more organizations were promoting ballot measure 2. And one or more organizations are currently opposing the repeal of ranked choice voting. And those organizations are, in fact, acting similar to political parties. But they are not registered as political parties. They don't have to follow the law like political parties. But they are, in fact, engaging in political discourse just like a political party might do. So just because we don't have a political party and a name to put to the opposition to ballot to repealing ranked choice voting doesn't mean that an organized group of people isn't doing that in a shadow. And that's what I'm concerned about, is that that's how we got ranked choice voting in the first place, is a non-political party organization organizing people to put something on the ballot and get it passed through what I consider nefarious means. And voters now have buyer's remorse. I personally went out and conducted numerous training sessions for people who did not understand about ranked choice voting. So when I hear people talking about people who are opposing this measure, this bill, saying, I think people can understand it. What they're basically saying is those people are liars that say they don't understand. And I was physically present with too many people to count where they did not understand what was going on. And I spent countless hours trying to train people to do that. So it is very disingenuous and very political for people to just say that those people are just wrong. It's just political. It is not political. I am I'll go to my grave believing that, because it was very clear to me at the time. These are people that don't normally engage in politics who did not understand. And at the time, I could not understand why, from a leadership perspective, we would want to make a election system more complicated. The purpose of leadership and the purpose of our government is supposed to be simplifying things for people. Keep it as simple as possible, and yet we've gone the opposite direction of complicating it. So because there is the action of a political party that is going on right now that's promoting or opposing the repeal of ranked choice voting, and they don't have the gumption to declare themselves as a political party, I'm going to oppose, or I'm going to support repealing ranked choice voting and going back to the way it was. And I would challenge those organizations to come up and be a political party because they're acting like one.
Thank you. I don't think I could have said it much better. I too participated in, invited the Alaskans, representative from the Alaskans for Better Elections to come and give instruction to every community in my district throughout the year prior to the last election, so that people could understand, and they left more confused than they did feeling confident that they liked this new system. I opposed ballot measure 2 from the beginning because of the reasons stated of why I brought this bill forward, is that I feel it's detrimental to seniors, to minorities, to those who don't have English as a first language, and that my own district said that it was a mandate to get rid of ranked choice voting. They tried it, they don't like it, and they want it gone. So there's been a lot of accusations that I'm doing this because I didn't like the outcome of the races. That is not true. There's been accusations saying that I'm a sore loser. I have won in my district by a majority vote 3 times. So this is not to get a certain political outcome. This is not based upon candidates. This is the focus, putting the focus back where it should be, and that is on the voter. The voters have said, no, we don't like it. We don't want it. And as Rep. Carpenter mentioned, we should try to simplify. This is the foundation of our government. It should be easy to understand. Even my youngest children know how to decide, I want the blue bike, or I want the red bike, I want the green bike, or I want the yellow bike. And they were able to tell me, I want that one, not that one. That's as simple as voting should be. And when we make it more complicated, fewer people are likely to engage. So this is why I brought the bill forward. It's not because I'm seeking any different outcome. I believe in the voice of the people and want as many people to engage as possible, and want them to feel confident that when they go cast their vote, that their vote will count. So would the recorder please I asked for a motion from Representative Carpenter.
I move that the House Judiciary Committee move House Bill 4 version 33-LS0094/B from committee as amended with the attached fiscal notes, and give legislative legal drafters permission to make all technical and conforming changes as necessary.
Object.
There's been an objection. Would the recorder please call the roll?
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Grove.
No.
Yes.
Representative
Keith. Yes.
Representative Gray.
No.
Vice Chair Howard.
Yes.
Chair Van.
Yes.
5 yeas, 2 nays.
By a vote of 5 yeas and 2 nays, House Bill 4 has passed from committee. We will take a brief at ease to sign the committee report and welcome Senator Klayman to the table to bring back Senate Bill 53. back on record. We now have Senate Bill 53 by Senator Klayman, Competency and Voluntary Civil Commitments, before us. And due to the constraints of time, I'd like to focus a lot of our questions. Previously, we had Mr. Skidmore from the Criminal Division addressing a lot of our questions. I do have Stephen Bookman from the Department of Law Civil Division to be able to answer our questions. We do have Mr. Skidmore available. We have Angela Harris online again to be able to answer our questions. So we have about a half an hour on this, and I have a lot of questions, but I'd like to bring us back to kind of the bigger picture of what this is solving. And Senator Klayman, if you could give us that first intro of where the criminal division meets civil division, and then we can go into questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator Matt Klayman, Senate District H. So the core part of the legislation is in Section 6, which is the transition when a person is being, a case is on the verge of being dismissed because a person is incompetent to stand trial, and it would then require the prosecutor for certain individuals that meet the statutory definition of dangerousness based on the crime they were charged with that's in the legislation, they would be required to file an involuntary commitment bill under Title 47, and that would start the civil proceeding. And that's really in terms of closing the gap. That's the key part of this legislation.
Thank you, Senator Klayman. Questions from committee members? Representative Carter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would think that the additional two-year commitment in Section 11 would be a significant portion of the bill. Why was 2 years selected?
Through the Chair, Representative Carpenter, the additional commitment is a key part of the bill, but in terms of closing a gap, today they can have repeating six-month commitments, so the power to hold somebody isn't any different with a two-year commitment as a six-year commitment, but the gap that was illustrated by Ms. Harris's case is the reason why I focus on Section 6 as the most important part of the legislation. The bill was introduced with a up to five-year commitment as the maximum that would be possible, and in Senate Finance that was amended from 5 years to 2 years.
Follow-up?
So for the record, what was the prior to the bill, or what is it currently? Sorry.
Through the Chair, Representative Carpenter, currently the maximum civil commitment is a six-month involuntary commitment they can keep filing every 6 months for another commitment.
And then follow-up? Madam Chair, through the Chair, what is the reason for moving from a six-month to a two-year, as it's stated now? That may not be your choice as bill sponsor because it was amended in another committee. Maybe you can speak to why you authored it as 5 years, and then I can ask the other committee why they dropped it down to two.
Obviously, through the chair, I can't speak for the other committee. The reason for the longer term of commitment is twofold. First, to give greater assurance to victims like Ms. Harris so that they don't every 6 months have to sit in and listen to an involuntary commitment hearing and face the fear that individual is going to be released every 6 months. They want additional insurance in terms of their own healing from what's happened to them. It can be really essential. The reasons that we had urged initially a five-year, or why the bill, as the bill sponsor, it had a five-year commitment was because I felt that was a fair balance between the period of time a person could be ordered into an involuntary commitment with their civil rights to be able to get released with measures that they could petition to be released if things had improved during that commitment. And I felt that was a reasonable balancing between civil liberties interests and protecting the public. I think that I can't speak explicitly for Senate Finance, but the discussion I would roughly describe that as they felt like that 2 years was a better balance in terms of civil liberties versus public safety.
Follow up. And this might be a question for the civil division, but if the bill is to pass, what would be the opportunity, what time frame opportunity for someone who has been committed to petition for release? Is that every 6 months? Is it every year?
Mr. Bookman, would you be able to answer the question for Representative Carpenter?
Thank you. This is Stephen Bookman with the Civil Division Department of Law through the chair. Section 11 does speak to that, and Actually, I think if we look at Section 13, that talks about how Section 13, page 10, line 4, it says that a respondent committed under this new section may petition the court for early discharge at any time during the commitment if the respondent presents some evidence demonstrating that they are no longer likely to cause serious harm to self or others. But they can't do that, if you look at paragraph E, within the first 6 months.
Follow up.
So I guess maybe this is a technical question, Madam Chair, and I'm not sure who to ask the question, but if a respondent is being medicated and is not of sound mind through medication, how would they be in a position to provide evidence that they can no longer pose a harm to themselves or others? What's the process?
We do now have Dr. Christy Becker, Chief of Clinical Services at Alaska Psychiatric Institute. Is that?
Let's start there.
Okay. Dr. Becker, would you be able to answer the question for Representative Carpenter?
Hello. For the record, this is Dr. Christy Becker with API. Through the chair, I cannot fully answer the question. I am a psychologist, not a psychiatrist, so I do not prescribe medication. However, an individual who stabilized on medication might theoretically be able to at least announce to their clinical team that they wish to leave, that they desired to be, you know, seen again about their dangerousness, and their legal representative arguably would be the one who would bring forward the concern of the patient that they would like to be seen or they would like to be reevaluated for dangerousness rather than, you know, the patient themselves being forced to petition. It is also plausible that the clinical team would reach a determination that the individual no longer met the criteria for dangerousness and would then contact the patient and the patient's counsel to try to follow up on this process. But it certainly does muddy the waters a bit when we put the onus on the patient who may or may not have the capacity to really advocate for themselves. So it's a bit of a mixed bag.
Okay, I'll pause there. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Becker, while we're on that, on page 5, and throughout other areas of the bill, it refers to a mental health professional. And on page 5, section H, if at any time the course of the detention a mental health professional at the detaining facility determines that the person does not meet the standards for commitment, the respondent shall be released from the facility. And what is the definition of mental health professional? Who has the authority to make those decisions?
Through the chair, that is a good question. So the licensed practitioner, which at API is usually a psychiatrist or a psychiatric nurse practitioner, so a mid-level provider, does have the authority over the patient and their case in terms of determining whether or not they meet clinical criteria for ongoing hospitalization. That said, in these cases, the mental health professional might be the named individual, the psychiatrist or the nurse practitioner. It could also be that a psychologist would be involved because the psychology staff at API are the ones who actually conduct the risk assessments for dangerousness. And then the psychologist would serve essentially as an informant to the psychiatrist, would provide an evaluation of dangerousness and risk with recommendations. And then that would help inform the psychiatrist or the psychiatric nurse practitioner's determination. But at the end of the day, the mental health professional in charge would be the licensed practitioner that is medicating the patient, and that is the signature on the patient's commitment paperwork.
Senator Klayman.
Put just a little bit, or for the record, Senator Matt Klayman, Madam Chair, just to make a certain clarity in terms of the structure of the bill, the section you're looking at on page 5 is section 5 of the bill, and those are specific provisions that deal with situations in which a person has been detained for evaluation, and there's been a wait for them to be brought in for the evaluation, and what that paragraph H specifically is addressing, the circumstance they're brought in for an evaluation and the clinic determines they no longer meet the criteria to hold for the evaluation.
Senator Klayman, in reading through, just trying to understand, there's certain sections of the bill that you specifically list a psychiatrist and or psychologist. Why in various sections did you not use those specific terms when it seems like there's a release valve that they could be no longer admitted without that specific examination?
Madam Chair, actually the language you see in Section H was primarily suggested by Department of Law in an amendment that we adopted on the Senate floor. And then that was reviewed by Ledge Legal before it was finalized. But I think to a large measure, that was language suggested by the Department of Law.
Thank you. Representative Crow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to also ask about Section 5. And I see both, obviously, Senator Klayman and the staff in front of us, but also perhaps Mark Regan from the Disability Law Center could address this, because I think that his agency may be involved. Through the chair, Senator Klayman, I understand that Section 5 was added on the Senate floor, and I'd like to understand the rationale behind it, why it was added on the as an amendment on the Senate floor, and whether you think it might affect a particular settlement in a particular case. Thank you.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Groh. The amendment, Section 5, that was added on the floor was at the request of the Civil Division in response to the Abigail and Jethro case, which was an April 28, 2023 Alaska Supreme Court decision that addressed circumstances of a person who's not, actually, the individuals in that case, there were no criminal proceedings. They were strictly civil proceedings, and they had been held, one in the Kodiak Island Hospital and another on the Kenai Peninsula, waiting space at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. And the Civil Division felt that there should be a better clarification of the standards that the court should be applying in making decisions about whether to hold somebody or not hold somebody when they're essentially in a purely civil commitment environment and not, there's no interplay with criminal charges in those matters, and provide more guidelines for the court to apply in determining when there's a wait to get into API or a wait for transportation, whether or not it was reasonable to hold the person or not, and the time at which they should be released.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Klayman, would this particular provision, the newly added Section 5, have any effect, including the weakening or undermining a settlement the state's entered into in a case, I think, that might be called DLC versus state?
Through the chair, we actually have spoken with that, with the lawyer from Disability Law Center, who's actually here in the room. He could certainly add, but the answer is that the state's obligation to comply with the terms of the Disability Law Center suit would not change by this legislation, and we have in our sponsor statement a paragraph to that effect.
Thank you. I would think it would be useful to hear from Mr. Reagan, since he does happen to be here, Mark, of Disability Law Center lawyer.
We have three people in the queue. I'd like to get to those and see what we can get addressed at this time. Representative Eason, I apologize. You were in the queue prior, and then Carpenter, and then Gray.
Thank you, through the chair, to the bill sponsor, Senator Klayman. In your exchange with Representative Carpenter a few minutes ago, you spoke about that the length of time of commitment and the hearings and so forth can play a significant role in the healing of a victim. And I wondered if you could speak a little bit more to that, and then I have a follow-up question.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I think just simply the assurance that comes with that the feeling on the victim's behalf that a person is going to be in custody, not in custody, but in an involuntary and commitment environment for longer gives them reassurance that we're actually taking care of somebody that's a danger to the community. Ms. Harris is on the line. If you want to hear from her on that, I think she can speak in a much more personal level about why that longer level of commitment, doesn't make a difference today, but how it would make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. A follow-up? And is the healing of a victim, or if there's multiple victims, is the healing of victims one of the criteria that we currently use when we're making a decision on whether or not someone should remain in a civil commitment setting?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, no.
Follow-up? And is that something that maybe we should look at adding to that criteria so that that's a factor in making that decision?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, that might be a better question directed to Mr. Bookman with the Civil Division.
Thank you. Can I ask a question, Mr. Bookman?
Yes, please continue.
Thank you. Through the chair to Mr. Bookman. Two questions. The first is my question to Senator Klayman. Did you hear that, and can you respond?
Yes, Representative, through the chair, and for the record again, this is Stephen Bookman with the Department of Law. The United States Supreme Court has said that civil commitment needs to be based on essentially two ideas, the precise wording of which they've left to the states, one being the idea of harm to others, and then the other idea being danger to self, and that whether that's intentional or unintentional, and those are the two bases on which civil commitment can be ordered. And so I think the perspective of the victim would not fall so much into the grounds for commitment, but it might fall into other areas such as the length of commitment.
Follow up? And more particularly, is that something that should be part of the criteria when someone is making an official decision on the length of commitment?
Through the chair, I don't think there's a strictly legal answer to that. I think that's a policy decision.
Thank you. Follow-up?
One more follow-up?
Yep, just one more. Thank you. Again, to Mr. Bookman. And I know you're on the Civil Division, but could you speak to this question? I'm interested to know basically a question on prosecutorial ethics, for lack of a better label. It seems in this bill we're putting a lot of weight on a prosecutor charging someone with a particular crime who, according to the bill, is going to be found not to be competent to stand trial. Can you speak to sort of the ethics of charging someone with a crime if you know or you expect that they're not going to be competent to stand trial in that crime? You're putting a charge on their permanent criminal record, which they're never going to have a trial to be able to basically prove their innocence and so forth. And is that normally done, or is there anything in terms of legal ethics that would kind of discourage that happening?
Through the chair, Representative, I don't deal with charging decisions, and I would defer to John Skidmore on that. I will say, with all of the DAs that I've interacted with, I have found them all to be extremely hardworking and honorable and ethical people.
Thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, my question is, who decides, and this is in regards to Section 13, Subsection D, who decides the evidence exists that demonstrates a respondent is not likely to cause harm? Who makes that decision? Is it just one person? Is it a team of people? Is there a check and balance here? Multiple opinions? Is that for the doctor?
We can try. Dr. Becker, can you answer the question for Representative Carpenter?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, could you please either repeat or restate the question? I had a hard time hearing it on the phone.
I certainly can. My apologies for not speaking loud enough. I am referring to Section 13D of the bill. My question is, who decides what evidence exists that demonstrates a respondent is not likely to cause harm that would enable them to petition the court? Who makes that decision?
Through the chair, that decision in regard to clinical dangerousness as it relates to a mental health concern is more or less determined by the practitioner through an evaluative process and through a risk assessment. But in terms of actual evidence, that's more of a legal term. And I might ask Mr. Bookman also to chime in on this question. Essentially, we assess dangerousness to the best of our ability. It is an imperfect area of our science. And to the degree that we are able, the most salient component of dangerousness is typically past behavior, but also stability of the mental illness and how the mental illness interacts with any potential for dangerousness is considered. So generally the practitioner, but in terms of evidence and the full determination legally, I think there's another component of that question Mr. Bookman should chime in on. Thank you.
Yeah, follow up with that.
Follow up.
Before we go to Mr. Bookman on that particular subject, if one clinician makes a determination that somebody is likely to continue harm, is there somebody else that reviews that determination? Is there a check and balance here, or is one person making a determination and that's gospel?
Through the chair, that is a good question. In the case of the patients in question here, often a psychologist is conducting a risk assessment based on risk assessment tools and measures and a standardized process that we utilize at the hospital. And then that assessment is presented to the licensed practitioner, either a psychiatrist, again, or a nurse practitioner, who is going to review that. And there is an interdisciplinary treatment team that is going to oversee that along with myself as the clinical lead and the chief of psychiatry. So the answer is yes, there are checks and balances, and the process is reviewed by a team, and any, you know, movement toward discharge or release from the facility of cases like these does have quite a lot of oversight.
And I guess I would then follow up with Mr. Booker for the final part of the question is what legal evidence is going to be necessary for a petition to go to the court?
Mr. Bookman.
Yes, through the chair, Representative, the respondent, as we see on line 6, would be presenting some evidence. That's a legal term, and the idea is that the respondent has to have a low quantum of evidence. They don't have to provide evidence. They don't have to provide a preponderance of the evidence, but they do have to provide something, some reason, to think there at least should be a hearing.
I guess that begs another question. Mr. Bookman, if the people that are in charge of deciding what evidence exists is not the respondent, then how does the respondent present evidence? Like the previous question when I asked it of the doctors is who decides what the clinical evidence is? That's the doctor and the medical team that provides decides that evidence. So then how would the respondent ever be able to provide their own evidence if it's up to the medical team to decide what evidence exists?
Through the chair, Representative, I think there could be two ways. One way is certainly that the specialized public defenders would hear from their client that they would like to leave. They're familiar with the process. And the current law allows an indigent person to have an independent examination done to examine the respondent and testify on their behalf. And so that could be one way to do it. If the respondent had funds to hire their own, that could be another way. I think also that the public defenders are well experienced in looking at medical records and medical opinions and what they could well be able to do is to say that because of the clear and convincing evidence burden, that there is reason to think that perhaps the medical team has decided that, you know, the respondent needs to remain at the hospital. But actually, it's a weak conclusion, Your Honor. There's a logical problem here and a logical problem there. And when you look at it, it's not actually clear and convincing, and we should have a full-blown hearing to talk about whether it is. Frankly, they're quite good at that. So I think there are two ways, hiring their own expert and carefully analyzing the API team's record of decision.
Thank you. And I, Madam Chair, I just want to say for the record that my line of questioning is not trying to find a way for mentally ill people to be let loose. It is to prevent abuse. And I need to understand the process a little better. That's why my line of question. I have another question, but I'll defer to others.
Thank you. We have opportunity for one last line of questioning, Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So through the chair to Senator Klayman and his staff, I would like to talk through, and I think as an example, maybe Angela Walker's assailant from December when he had assaulted the two previous people. If this bill were in law, he would have been arrested. And then is it the police officers would have suspected? Who initially suspects this person is mentally incompetent? At what point do we start this process of establishing that somebody may not be competent to stand trial?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, Senator Matt Klayman. In December, Mr. Akovec had assaulted two women, and he was arrested for that conduct. And I don't know, I assume he was taken to jail. I don't know, but presumably he was taken to jail and criminal charges were filed. And then during the course of those criminal charges, I think in large measure because he had had prior criminal cases and the public defender probably knew from the prior cases or from the communications with him that he might not be competent to stand trial. At one point, the public defender raised his competence, and then the court, based on that competence, would have ordered him for some kind of evaluation. I don't know the exact process in that, whether because he had been previously found incompetent, the court may have had a shorter process or a longer process, but during the course of those court proceedings, there was a determination made by the court after considering what evidence was available that he was not competent to stand trial. And at that point in time, the court dismissed the charges against him. And I don't know whether that was a motion made by the public defender or it may have been made by the prosecution, but there was a motion made and the court ruled to dismiss the charges based on, I think there was no one argued that he was competent. I think the prosecution and the defense all agreed that he was incompetent. The charges were dismissed and he was released to the community. How this bill would change things is at that point in time, just before the charges were dismissed because of his prior criminal history and psychiatric history, they would have filed a petition for involuntary commitment at that time. And instead of his being released to the community, an involuntary commitment process would then have been initiated.
Follow up. So maybe let's not talk about the specific case. Let's say somebody assaulted somebody and was arrested. And I assume the police officers think this person is mentally ill and maybe incompetent, or maybe, I don't know. I want to know at what point does someone say, I think this person might be incompetent. And then we start an evaluation process. I've read the bill. Maybe everyone else has a better understanding on it. And so I apologize. I see 30 days. Are they restored? 4-month wait list for a restorative bed. 60 days, 90 days, 180 days, petition for 2 years. I want to talk through someone assaulted somebody. They've been arrested. And I want to learn about that person. And I would like to hear an example of when we go to 2 years. I want to learn about where they are in this 4-month waiting period for the restorative bed at API. Where are they held? What is happening to them? If you could use a hypothetical person who commits assault who is incompetent to stand trial. I'm gonna throw this in there. I'm a little worked up. My understanding is that if they become competent, they're not released, then they're competent to stand trial. So then they are charged with their charges. they're not released. If you're competent, then you get charged for what you were charged for. And if I'm wrong, I want to be talked through this case and understand how somebody could be charged for a violent crime and then let out to the public when they're competent and not charged for that crime. But also all these dates and things in here, and these 30 days and 60 days and 90 days and 24 month days. I want to, can you just explain it for us simply?
Representative Gray, I think this is an excellent line of questions that I believe all of us are seeking to understand, but I don't think that Representative Glayman is going to be able to give a full picture within a couple minutes.
Okay.
So that's my intent, is to be able to answer all of those questions, and we have a lot of professionals who are going to help us understand that process. So my apologies, Senator Glayman. I will let you give a very brief response to that, and we will have to conclude this meeting for today just because of lack of time. But Representative Gray, you're exactly where we need to go, is understanding this process so that we can look at how the bill fits in that. So Representative Glayman, I will, out of respect, give an opportunity to respond.
Sure, Madam Chair. But before you recess for the day and before I answer, could we take a brief at ease and we could touch base briefly about scheduling?
Brief at ease. Back on the record, Senator Glayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Senator, or Representative Gray, there are two processes at play, and the periods of commitment are easily confused, and your question actually confused those. So on the criminal side, there's only a 6-month period of restoration hold that if the court finds there is a reason to believe they will be restored during an additional 6-month period, that the defendant can be held for essentially up to a year for restoration. And if at the conclusion of that or during the course of that they conclude that they can't be restored, then the court would dismiss the case. Of course, if they did become competent, then the criminal case continues and there's no involuntary commitment issue and there's no longer a competency question, and the case is an active criminal case that would be resolved in the normal course of affairs. Then the next proceedings that take place are the involuntary commitment proceedings that, as addressed by this bill, involve specifically individuals that meet that the stat they've been charged with certain crimes that are a certain level of dangerousness. And those individuals if the charge was dismissed because they were incompetent, you're on the criminal side, then just prior to dismissal, the prosecutor would initiate the civil commitment proceeding by filing a new lawsuit, a new case, but it's effectively a new lawsuit seeking involuntary commitment of the person whose charges are about to be dismissed. And after those, after that petition was filed by the prosecutor, then the civil division would take over the involuntary commitment. And then there are options after the 72-hour assessment, there would be options of a 30-day commitment. And if they held them for 30 days, then they could file again and extend that from 30 days to 90 days. Then there would be the option of extending the 90 days to 180 days. And then at the conclusion of the 180 days, there could be yet another petition filed only involving these dangerous individuals for a, up to 2-year commitment. For anyone else that doesn't have the dangerous crimes in their history, the maximum commitment would be 180 days.
Thank you, Senator Klayman. And I know that members have a lot of other questions, and we will have a lot of other people available when we can hear this bill again. I'm going to set Senate Bill 53 aside for the time being. That concludes our business for today. Seeing there is no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect. It is 4:11 p.m.